Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Ben Edwards, and you're listening to You're the Cure. Thanks again for joining us for another great show. I've got an amazing guest today. And as our longtime listeners know, I very much like to drill down to the very root cause of diseases, which really are just consequences of poor stewardship, and a lot of times from lack of knowledge. So we're all about not bringing knowledge and teaching and bringing the truth so that people can steward their health and not need a doctor. My goal is to put me out of business, put Veritas Medical out of business. So that truly is our mission and our goal. But to do that, we need to bring information in that is, number one, it's the truth. But number two, sometimes it's so simple, it's hard to believe. It's so simple that you can just eat real food and move a little bit every hour and get good, clean, mineralized, structured water into your body and be at peace. So those are the four pillars: nutrition, hydration, movement, and peace. But my guest today, I think, would add a fifth pillar called breathing, nasal breathing in particular. So I'm super excited and happy to have Patrick McKeon on our show today. OxygenAdvantage.com is his website. And Patrick is an international practitioner and author. He's authored seven publications. Probably the most well-known, I would say, is The Oxygen Advantage. And on Patrick's website, again, that's theoxygenadvantage.com, Patrick states that his mission is to empower people to take control of their own health, well-being, and fitness using simple breathing exercises proven to improve body oxygenation. And let me just say this, Patrick, I was so excited when I first got introduced to you by a friend and started diving into your work that this lines up so much with what we preach at Veritas. To allow the body to function as it was designed to function, we need to know these basic truths that we've lost. Our ancestors seem to know them innately, and we've lost that wisdom, and we rely on the modern healthcare system, which obviously has given us very poor results. So thank you for what you do, and welcome to the show. We're so glad to have you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Dr. Edwards. It's always very, very, you know, fulfilling to hear a medical doctor talking about ways that you can help to deal with your own health, because too often it's not about preventative, but it's about maintaining or managing an illness, you know. So I think, we'll have a good conversation about breathing. And for your listeners that don't know so much about it, I would say stay tuned. I think you'll learn something from it.
Right. Well, I want to remind our listeners that this chronic disease epidemic we're seeing, which, and I'm sure we'll talk about the current pandemic, COVID-19, but the real epidemic is all the chronic disease. The things people die from in America and Western societies are heart attacks. And the first reported case of a myocardial infarction in the United States was 1912. There was one case in all the medical literature, and now there's 600 plus thousand Americans a year die from heart disease. So these are new epidemics over the last 100 years. So something has changed, and it's not our genetics. It's our diet and our lifestyle. And so I just want to always remind people, don't get stuck in gene theory. And what Patrick's going to explain today lines right up with that. It's all about epigenetics and even something as simple as the way we breathe. So, Patrick, I'd like to start with, I think our listeners always appreciate a little bit of, as much as you want to share, of your personal journey of how you got to where you are today, talking about breathing and oxygenation of the body. So give us a little background, of course, where you're from. That accent, I believe, is Irish, but tell the listeners a little bit about your journey.
Sure. I was growing up as a child with asthma, and I was born in 1973. And so diagnosed with asthma probably at about 4 years of age. Doctors were initially reluctant to diagnose asthma. They called it at the time, it was chronic bronchitis. And I can remember wheezing as a child, and it was getting progressively worse. There wasn't medication for it. And the one thing about it wasn't just asthma, because if you have asthma, you've also a sleep problem. So I was a heavy snorer. My nose was constantly stuffed up, and I was a chronic mouth breather. And so, with that, you have fatigue. And because of mouth breathing, you tend to be more highly strung, more upper chest breathing, more fight or flight. And I had obstructive sleep apnea, even though it wasn't diagnosed at the time. I had no idea what it was. But I remember seeing in university dorms, and the students the next day, they thought I was going to die because they'd hear me snoring my head off. And then all of a sudden, I would stop breathing. And they were a bit concerned with that. And sure, I didn't, as a student, you don't really care, you know. you kind of just learn to get on with whatever it is. So I came across, 1998, I read a newspaper article, and it was about the work of a Russian doctor who worked during the Soviet space race, and part of his research was determining breathing and the composition of oxygen for going into space for astronauts. And when he was working with his patients, he noticed that their patients, as they got sicker, they tended to breathe harder and more upper chest. And he asked the question, he said, was it their sickness that was causing their hard breathing, or was it their hard breathing that was feeding back into their sickness? So we started working with people with asthma, teaching them to breathe through their nose, slow down their breathing, normalize their breathing rate so their breathing wasn't fast, their breathing wasn't upper chest. And I started doing that because I was a chronic mouth breather, hard breather, fast breather. And he said two things. He said, breathe through your nose and breathe light. And that's where it all began. So that was 20 years ago, 22 years ago. It completely changed my life. I ended up changing my career then to kids. And my background, I had an economics degree at that time, changed careers, and moved into the field of breathing purely by accident.
Wow, that's amazing. So how long did it take when you started, when you read the article and started implementing some things, how long are we talking before you started seeing changes in your physical health?
Well, it's no exaggeration, but when I started switching from mouth to nose breathing, there are exercises to decongest the nose. And this has been known since 1923 that, for example, if the female isn't pregnant or if you don't have serious medical conditions, if you have a stuffy nose and you want to open up your nose, just simply take a breath in and out through your nose, pinch your nose, hold your nose, and walk around holding your breath. And continue walking and holding your breath until you feel a medium to strong air hunger. And then let go and breathe in through your nose. And you'll find that your nose starts to open. So on the first day I was doing that exercise, and I was finding I was able to open my nose, but I was feeling suffocated. I was feeling air hunger because I had spent years of mouth breathing. And I kept on breathing through my nose. And that night I wore a BreatheRight strip to help open up my nose. And I actually used paper tape across my lips to get my mouth closed. So the first morning I woke up, I think I was just getting used to it. But the second morning, after having my mouth taped and wearing a nasal dilator, I woke up feeling the most alert that I had in years. And my wheezing was reducing by about 50% in the first week, just by getting my mouth closed. And I know that sounds such an exaggeration and such an oversimplicity, but that was the way it was. You know, there was no, because of course, I was going around not realizing, you know, as an asthmatic kid with my mouth open, hard breathing, fast breathing, you know, and in terms of the theory, you're taking cold, dry, unfiltered air into your lungs. Your lungs, your mouth performs no function in terms of breathing. There is no function provided by the mouth in terms of breathing. There's no defense provided by the mouth. So really, it's important when we switch to nasal breathing. And also, nose breathing is connected with lower breathing, with greater breathing, greater regions, greater amplitude of the diaphragm. And the benefits of it are, like, there are many, many benefits, but I felt it pretty straight away. Certainly in a week, I noticed I was on the right track.
Wow. Well, can you speak to, you've mentioned upper chest breathing versus lower breathing. Could you tell the listeners a little bit about what do you mean by that and what's the difference between those?
Yeah, like dysfunctional breathing is typically when our breathing is a little bit faster than what it should be. And if you were to look at somebody breathing, I'm assessing, are they breathing high? Is there more movement from the upper chest that when they take a breath in, you see the upper chest rising, and when they exhale, their upper chest is falling? Versus are they breathing low? And when we talk about low, we're talking about greater amplitude of the diaphragm. So, you know, breathing down into the lower regions of the lungs. So when we take a breath in, it's normal that the abdomen moves out a little bit, our sides move out, and there's some movement to the back as well, because the diaphragm is like the ceiling, and you've got the pelvic floor, and you've got the abdominals to the front, and you've got the spinal muscles to the back. So our diaphragm breathing muscle performs, it's a very important role it performs in terms of breathing. And as the diaphragm moves downwards, you'll have movement on all four sides of the body. Just a little bit. The best thing to do would be to look at a cat breed or to look at a young baby breed. Both will be nasal breeders. Both will generally be slow breeders unless, of course, well, the baby, I suppose, has a higher metabolism, breeds a little bit faster. But they will be regular breeders and they will be breeding using the diaphragm. And there's a number of benefits to it. Your diaphragm breathing muscle is not just for respiration, but it also provides stabilization of the spine. So with breathing, if the diaphragm moves back up to its resting position after an exhalation, and then it's the exhalation that determines the inhalation. So when you have an adequate amplitude of the diaphragm, that's helping to support the spine by virtue of the pressure that's generated. And I suppose most people will think that, yeah, when you're going to lift something, you typically breathe in and you hold your breath for just a brief moment. And as you breathe in and hold your breath, your diaphragm is moving downwards and it's bracing the abdomen. That it's almost that the abdomen becomes a pneumatic balloon to provide stabilization for the spine. So people with lower back pain often have dysfunctional breathing patterns. So if one is breathing faster on upper chest, you're not getting the benefits of the diaphragm for functional movement. But also, upper chest breathing and fast breathing is typically more fight or flight, that you're in a stress response. And mouth breathing is activating the upper chest. All you have to do is look down at your chest and take a breath through the mouth. And you will see that when you breathe through the mouth, you see a greater amplitude from the upper regions of the lungs. And also, for sleep, and this has been known, it was published back in the Lancet in 2014, that when you breathe through your, well, when you breathe with greater amplitude of the diaphragm, it increases lung volume. Because you're using, of course, you're using more of your lungs. And this in turn causes a stiffening of the throat, a stiffening and dilation of the throat. And this is very important during sleep. So me as a mouth breather, I was breathing fast and shallow. And by having my mouth open, my tongue wasn't resting in the roof of the mouth. And if your tongue isn't resting in the roof of the mouth, it's encroaching on the airway. So the upper airway then becomes more narrow. And as a result of mouth breathing, you're causing drying out of the upper airway, trauma to the upper airway. That contributes to inflammation. And as the upper airway becomes narrow, you've got increased resistance to breathing, because as you're breathing, then there's a greater negative pressure in the upper airway, which can contribute to collapse of the airway. And this would be, say, for instance, if it's upper airway resistance syndrome, or if it's hypopnea, or if it's an obstructive apnea. And in terms of health, I really think that sleep is a huge impact here. But breathing plays a huge role in sleep. And any of, like I always say to the students coming into me, if any of you are waking up with a dry mouth in the morning, you are not waking up feeling alert. You're more likely to have to get up to go to the bathroom during the night. You're more likely to be snoring. There's an increased risk of obstructive sleep apnea. And if you have obstructive sleep apnea, that definitely plays a toll on your health. And as you mentioned, hypertension and obstructive sleep apnea go hand in hand, because if you're stopping breathing during sleep due to collapse of the airways, that's putting the body into a fight or flight response that drives up blood pressure. And when that's repeated night after night, week after week, the high blood pressure that's happening during the stopping of the breath, that eventually carries into our everyday life. So if somebody presents to me and they said that they have high blood pressure, I'm always considering two things. What is their stress levels and what is their sleep level? What is their sleep like? So breathing itself, you know, you think of people with asthma in the United States, you're going to have maybe about 8% of the population, the Western population, typically have asthma. And many of those people with asthma, because of the inflammation of the lungs, that it's a universe. Whatever happens in the lungs travels up to the nose and vice versa. So people with asthma, with inflammation of their lungs, meaning that the inner walls of the airways are they're inflamed or that they're swelled up, so it's difficulty in breathing, and this manifests in coughing and wheezing, that inflammation in the lungs can travel up to the nose, so they have a stuffy nose. So then they are more likely to mouth-breathe, and they're taking cold, dry, unfiltered air. They're not harnessing nitric oxide. So, you know, you're taking that unfiltered air into your lungs, and you're you're 1.8 times more likely to have sleep disorder breathing. So, you know, how we breathe is impacting our emotions, It's impacting our sleep, and it's impacting, of course, respiration. Somebody with respiratory conditions, and you know, it's very seldom that I hear any healthcare professional saying to somebody with asthma, "Breathe through your nose," and it just doesn't make sense not to say it, because you know, of all people, people with asthma should be highly protective of their lungs, and the mouth is not protecting the lungs in any shape or form. The nose is our natural first line of defense of air as it's drawn into the lungs. And the other thing about this is when you're breathing through your nose and you're harnessing nasal nitric oxide, and this was discovered by the work of Professor John Lundberg. He's professor of nitric oxide from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. So it's like Europe's Mayo Clinic. And he said that when you're breathing through your nose, you're harnessing this gas, nitric oxide. And nitric oxide, as it's carried by the airstream into the lungs, nitric oxide helps to redistribute the blood throughout the lungs. And nasal breathing helps to redistribute the air throughout the lungs, so you're breathing low. And with that, then, you've got a greater oxygen uptake in the blood. So the PO2 in the blood increases by 10% with nasal breathing. And also, by virtue of the resistance to your breathing, by breathing through your nose, you're slowing down your breathing during wakefulness. Slow breathing has a calming effect on the mind, whereas fast and upper chest breathing has more of an agitation effect on the mind. And that was discovered by Stanford Medical School when they identified the new structure in the brain in March of 2017. So the nose performs so many different functions, and it's not just about just breathing through the nose. You know, we also want to look at breathing. We want to look at the biochemistry of the breath. We want to look at the biomechanics of breathing and cadence breathing. And like the biochemistry is centered on carbon dioxide. And I know most people will say carbon dioxide is a waste gas. But carbon dioxide is responsible for, it plays a role in vasodilation and helping to improve blood circulation. For example, people with dysfunctional breathing often have cold hands and cold feet. And if you slow down your breathing to the point of a slight air hunger, which signifies that carbon dioxide is increasing in the blood, you can influence your blood circulation. And also, when you have normal slow breathing with normal pressure of carbon dioxide in the blood, with increased CO2, you have a right shift to what's called the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve, or basically the Bohr effect. That the red blood cells, and hemoglobin is a protein within the red blood cells carrying oxygen, that hemoglobin releases oxygen more readily in the presence of carbon dioxide. So people talk about, you know, bring in oxygen and get rid of this waste gas, carbon dioxide. And yes, it's true that we breathe to breathe out excess CO2, but don't breathe too hard. Don't breathe too fast, because we get rid of too much carbon dioxide from the blood through the lungs. And our blood vessels constrict, and less oxygen gets delivered to tissues and organs. And suppose people will understand that if I said to you to take a breath in and out of your mouth, 10 big breaths, many people will feel lightheaded. That's not a sign of superoxygenation or hyperoxia. That's a sign of, you know, reduced blood flow to the brain. The clotted arteries are constricting as a result of breathing too much air. And this is why stress makes us breathe harder and faster, and we can't think straight. And, you know, the very time that we need blood flow and oxygen delivery to the brain, we're not getting it because of the stress and the impact it's having on our breathing. That's why I say, like, to people, if they're stressed, just make sure that you really get your breathing under control, because if you're stressed, even though it's the last thing that you'll feel that you'll want to do, start slowing down your breathing, because it's sending a message to the limbic system that the body is not under threat. Because our evolution was always synonymous that stress and fast and hard breathing go together. So when we breathe slowly, the body automatically takes it that everything is okay, and it will bring you back into relaxation. And Harvard medical doctor Herbert Benson wrote about this back in 1975. He published his book, The Relaxation Response. He said, on the basis that stress makes people sick, relaxation will help make them better. And it's through the breath that we can help to activate the body's relaxation response.
Okay, I want to summarize a little bit. The diaphragm, the muscle going across the abdomen, I want the listeners to envision this, or just look down at your chest, put your hand on your upper chest, put your hand on your belly, take a breath through your nose, and your hand on your belly should rise more than the hand on your chest. And if the hand on your chest is rising, moving more, then that means you're an upper airway breather. You're a chest or upper airway breather. And what Patrick is saying is when that happens, lots of negative consequences to that. That's a fight or flight breathing pattern that will stimulate the part of your brain that triggers fight or flight and the stress pattern. And also, you're not going to have the same effect on stabilization of the spine because of the pressures in the abdominal cavity. When if you were breathing properly, it would stabilize the spine more. You're not going to oxygenate as well when you're upper air breathing, when just that chest is in motion. And then you're not going to get the benefits of nitric oxide. And I want to, and there's some others, but I want to pause on that because that nitric oxide I find fascinating because I just read a study in relationship to infections, and obviously COVID-19 is in the news now. But and I've heard you on another video talk about that your natural mechanism of breathing through the nose. So could you walk through that from an immune system and germ killing standpoint? I've heard you talk about the air speeds up because of the nostrils, but then it slows down when it hits further into your sinus cavities with the turbinates, and then the particles can fall to the floor of the nasal cavity. And just that whole mechanism of what I would call the natural mask that God originally gave us, as opposed to the man-made mask everybody's wearing now. Can you talk to some of that germ killing effect of proper breathing?
Yeah, like when we're thinking about COVID-19, I suppose we have to think about two things. And one is the viral load. We have to think about the dose of the virus that we're taking into the body. And we have to think of the exposure, of the duration of exposure. And when we breathe through our nose, both individuals who are not infected, when you breathe through your nose, you tend to breathe less air because there is a resistance to your breathing. And by breathing less air, you're less, you know, that automatically is going to reduce the load that you are taking into your body. And in a crowded place, I would make an unconscious effort of even holding my breath, breathing, slowing down my breathing, and taking in minimal air. But even for somebody who's infected, so say you have a family member infected, and they are in respiratory symptoms, and their breathing is faster and harder, it's inevitable that they will breathe out through an open mouth. When you breathe out through an open mouth, there's a 42% greater water loss breathing out through the mouth. And the virus is carried by airborne particles via water particles. So mouth breathing is going to transmit a greater aerosol of water particles into the air, which is going to increase the risk of transmission if people are close by. So we would say to people, everybody breathe in and out through your nose and really slow down your breathing. And when you breathe through your nose and you slow down your breathing, you harness greater concentration of nitric oxide. And nitric oxide in tests back in 2005 with SARS coronavirus showed that nitric oxide inhibited the replication of the virus. Now, this was a laboratory experiment. I'm not saying that nitric oxide from the nose is going to stop COVID. I'm not saying that at all. But what I am saying is that nitric oxide does have some defensive properties. It is antiviral and it's antibacterial. And it's providing some scope in terms of neutralizing the virus as it comes into the body. And it may be by nasal breathing that you're taking less of a virus into the body. You have less of a viral load. And as a result, your immune system might be better able to cope with it. And I know one article that was published back a few weeks ago by researchers from Taiwan, and they spoke about nasal breathing, and they spoke about nitric oxide, and they spoke about nose breathing during sleep, because nose breathing during sleep is allowing your immune system to recover adequately, or is allowing your immune system to launch an active response to the virus. So, breathing, I'm so surprised that nobody has talked about nose breathing. Like, I went to get my hair cut the other day, and it's mandatory in public that we wear masks, especially if we go into shops. And so I was getting my hair cut, and the barber, he had a mask on. And, I was just listening to him breathe with the mask on. And because, of course, wearing the mask, you're exhaling carbon dioxide into the mask, and then you're breathing that carbon dioxide back into your lungs. Now, the human body needs a certain amount of carbon dioxide. And what you're exhaling into the mask is the it's a pressure of carbon dioxide in your lungs, 5%. You're rebreathing that carbon dioxide back into the body, and you might feel air hunger because of the increased CO2. So obviously he felt air hunger, and instead then he's breathing fast and shallow. And it's completely inefficient, completely uneconomical, you know, because if he's breathing fast and shallow, he's ventilating the upper regions of the lungs. He's wasting so much air in terms of dead space, because every breath that we take into the body, not all of that air that we take into the body arrives down into the small air sacs in the lungs for gas exchange to take place. So ultimately, when we breathe, we should be considering, how can I breathe to get as much of the air that I'm breathing in down into the small air sacs in the lungs, so that oxygen can transfer from the lungs into the blood and carbon dioxide can transfer from the blood into the lungs. And the key there is to breathe slow, because every breath that we take, 150 milliliters of that air doesn't get down into the small air sacs, it stays in dead space. So if we are breathing fast, if we're breathing, say, 20 breaths per minute, well, there's 20 by 150 mil, which means that 3 liters of air in that minute is staying in dead space. So in order to improve alveolar ventilation, or the air that's getting down into the small air sacs, and by improving alveolar ventilation, you also improve your blood oxygen saturation. So people who may be infected with respiratory distress, that their blood oxygen saturation is dropping, that you can help to improve your blood oxygen saturation by slowing down your breath, by taking fuller breaths, but not by over-breathing. So really the thing with breathing is to breathe slow and to breathe low, and not to over-breathe, you know, because over-breathing, you get rid of too much carbon dioxide. So you want a balance. You want a balance between slow breathing, low breathing, and light breathing. So coming back then, if you were to Google nitric oxide COVID-19, you'll see that quite a few companies are conducting clinical trials in the United States, because of the, you know, inhalation of nitric oxide as a treatment of COVID. But our nose produces nitric oxide in the nasal cavity and the paranasal sinuses. And we don't harness nasal nitric oxide if we breathe through the mouth. So breathing through the mouth completely bypasses nasal nitric oxide. And it just makes total sense to breathe in and out through your nose. And also in a crowded place, breathe hardly any air. Or if you see somebody coughing or sneezing, you know, if that's the way that the virus is being transmitted airborne, with greater amount of particles getting into the atmosphere by a cough, as soon as you see somebody coughing, hold your breath and walk away. Do whatever you can not to, you know, not to take that virus into the body. And I think, you know, the other aspect is, like, I put a video out on YouTube and it kind of went viral, but many people who had COVID actually practiced the exercises, and they commented on the difference that it made. Because when we have breathing problems, like me as a kid with asthma, I was breathing fast, I was breathing up her chest, you're feeling air hunger. It's very uncomfortable, you're feeling suffocated. And you respond to that feeling of suffocation by breathing harder and faster. But all it does is make things worse. You know, if you're feeling breathless and suffocated, the last thing that we should do, even though we feel we want to do it, but the last thing we should do is breathe fast and shallow. Always think, you know, you could put your hands either side of your lower ribs. So just, for instance, the lower two ribs, if you have your hands on your side, either side, and as you breathe in, and you could do it, say, breathe in for 5 seconds, but breathe very, very slowly in for five. So you're breathing in, 2, 3, 4, 5, out, 2, 3, 4, 5. So by doing that, you're slowing down your breathing and you're breathing low, and that's improving alveolar ventilation. So that will help to, you know, it will help to reduce the drop to your blood oxygen saturation, and it will also help to reduce that feeling of suffocation, which is not nice. So don't, like, it again, it's not about mouth breathing and fast breathing, it's about nose breathing and slow breathing and low breathing.
Awesome. Well, Patrick, we're up against a break. When we come back, I want to talk about kids, tonsillectomies, adenoids being taken out for snoring and sleep apnea and all that. But also just babies mm-hmm. and when they're born, and just the structure of the dental arch, and why are these kids, why do people in general, but kids in particular, have these small airways and airway issues. And we'll get into some of that. And also when we get back, I'm reading a fascinating book right now that I actually got from a video from you, Patrick, Shut Your Mouth, Save Your Life. Such a neat book. Side note, my two and a half year old, she heard me telling my wife about this book and overheard me say the title of the book. And later on that day, she told my wife, Mom, shut your mouth, save your life. So that book's been loved at our house for many different reasons, but our 2-year old in mm-hmm. particular has been using that. So we'll talk about that book too, from the 1800s, actually. Mm-hmm. Stick with us. We'll be right back. We're talking with Patrick McKeon, his website, oxygenadvantage.com. Everybody check it out in the book, The Oxygen Advantage. This is Ben Edwards. You're the Cure. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Patrick McKeon is with us today. He's author of The Oxygen Advantage, his website, oxygenadvantage.com. We're talking breathing, nasal breathing in particular. And Patrick, before we go into kind of the next topic, speak briefly on your website or your classes. I heard you mention instructors. So tell the listeners a little bit more about ways they can learn more or get connected with you, or what's the best way to kind of follow you.
Sure. We have websites. One of our websites for health is called buteycoclinic.com. And I give workshops, 2-hour workshops, whereby I guide people through the exercises. So I've got workshop for people with asthma. I've got another workshop for people with sleep disordered breathing, including insomnia, snoring, and obstructive sleep apnea. I've got another workshop then for people with panic disorder and anxiety. And also on that website, our children's program is completely free. So we have about 9 breathing exercises for children, showing them how would you teach children. So it's the same exercise that I would teach if the child comes into my own studio. So basically we record the exercise, we put them out there, and we want to get the information out there for children. I think it's really, really important. It's very important for adults, but children, it's even more important. And I was a child growing up with my mouth open, and nobody told me in 20-something years, not one person told me to breathe through my nose, despite having chronic mouth breathing. So that's why I'm always trying to change the way I put that.
Yeah, thank you for making that available, and I encourage everybody to check that out. And speaking of kids, and in your history as a kid with asthma, so many kids, as you mentioned, have asthma. A number of kids, obviously, now with ADD, ADHD, anxiety issues, just the world we live in with stress. There's so many conditions, even kind of secondary conditions. 54% of American kids have some sort of chronic disease. And as my listeners know, we always talk about the mitochondria and how inflammation starts down at the mitochondrial level. When the mitochondria can't make energy, can't clear the exhaust, and part of that energy formula is oxygen plus fuel plus spark plug equals energy. So oxygen is a huge part of this whole thing. And we oftentimes will refer back to Weston A. Price, researcher who looked at ancestral tribes and how they lived and had health. And one thing he noted was the dental arches would be wide in these ancestral groups and people that were eating a native diet. And what he went on to discover was the fat-soluble vitamins in particular, A, D, and K, played a role in the development of the fetus's dental arch, their bone structure in their mouth. And so these native tribes, they didn't need braces and orthodontics. And when they started to eat sugar and modern foods, but mainly sugar and refined flour, it started changing that dental structure. So can you speak some to the origins of this small mouth, this save your life, shut your mouth, save your life, maybe speak some to that. But just in general, historically, our ancestors apparently did not have all these problems related to mouth breathing. So can you speak some to the history of that?
Yeah, it's very interesting. If you go to Europe and if you go into a natural history museum and if you look at skulls, you'll typically see that, you know, most of the teeth are intact. you'll see these broad, wide arches. In terms of, you'll see that there's plenty of room for all 32 teat, and there's no overcrowding of teat. And you'll see a very nice U-shaped maxilla, so the top jaw is U-shaped. And if that person was, you know, when they were alive, when they were smiling, this is the best indicator of it. You know, I use an example, I put it up in terms of Prince William. So anybody, I don't know how much your listeners might be into the royal family, but here's an example. Prince William is married to a beautiful-looking woman called Kate Middleton. And if you put in Prince William and Kate Middleton into Google and put up a photograph, and just look at the two of them smiling, and count the amount of teeth that you can see with Prince William, you'll see that he's got a narrow jaw, and you'll see black triangles either side of the smile. And when he smiles, you'll typically see maybe 6 or 7 teeth. And then when you look at Kate Middleton and you count the amount of teeth that you can see with her, you'll typically see maybe 10 or 11 teeth in the top jaw. Now, what this means is that Prince William has a smaller jaw than Kate. And the problem with a smaller jaw is that there may not be enough room for the tongue. And when there's not enough room for the tongue has only got two places to be. It's either in the roof of the mouth or it's falling into the airway. And if the tongue is falling into the airway because of a small mouth, then you've got a small airway, and now you've got a problem with, in terms of sleep. So why has it changed? Well, I think Weston Price really, you know, I think he got it, even though people can criticize his scientific gathering at the time. But we have to bear in mind that the book is written back in the 1930s. And what he did with the available wisdom at that time was phenomenal. His observations were amazing. He's documented everything with photographs. If you read his book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, you will see numerous photographs there of the primitive groups of people when they were eating their natural diet, that they had all teeth, but beautiful wide facial structures. They didn't have collapsed nostrils. They didn't have narrow faces. They didn't have overcrowding of teeth, because it's not just about the overcrowding of teeth. It's about the size of the airway. And, you know, it's really, really phenomenal now. If you go into a junior school with youngsters, you will see that many of them now are needing braces, that the size of the human face has changed. And just 100 years ago, or 50 years ago, we had better facial structures. And really what it's about, again, it is about the airway. And it's probably lack of chewing of foods that has caused and contributed to this as well. So there's a few different things. One is lack of breastfeeding. Breastfeeding is not just about nutrition for the infant, but it's about manipulation of the muscles necessary for craniofacial growth. It takes work for the baby to extrapolate the milk from the breast. And by working those muscles of the jaw during the sucking on the breast, the baby is, those muscles are being developed for good muscle tone of the face, so that the baby then is more likely then to be innate nasal breather. Now, I listen, I'm not here talking, you know, to give out about mothers or anything like that. Society is messed up with this one, because you have mothers, they're having a baby, and there's so much pressure on them to go back to work. The young couple is trying to pay a mortgage, so I understand all that. Pacifier use. Every 1 year of a use of a pacifier, it increases the risk of mouth-breathing by 25%. Tum sucking, because when the child has the tum in the roof of the mouth, they're sucking their jaws inwards. And, you know, the top jaw, the maxilla, is very, very soft during infant years. So many things can help to influence it. And, you know, I looked at a dreadful paper, Death and Nasomaxillary Complex. It was written by Dr. Christian Gimeno. And Dr. Gimeno, he coined the phrase obstructive sleep apnea back in Stanford in the 1970s. And sadly, he passed on about 6 months ago, 8 months ago. But he wrote a lot about the critical importance of restoring nasal breathing during childhood. And in one paper, he looked at 7 infants who died as a result of sudden infant death syndrome. And in all of those infants, they all had a high narrow palate. And the problem was that an infant is an innate nasal breather because they're not able to mouth breathe, because during the first few months of life, that the soft palate at the back of the mouth and the epiglottis meet. So the baby is forced to breathe exclusively through the nose. But if you have a child with a compromised airway and their palate, which is the roof of the mouth, if that's infringing into the nasal cavity, because the roof of the mouth is the floor of the nose, so if the roof of the mouth is high and if it's zoned upwards, obviously it's taking space away from the nose. So therefore, the baby is not able to breathe adequately through the nose. And in some of these cases, the only thing preceding death was that the baby had a runny nose, rhinitis. And of course, it was rhinitis that tipped the baby over the edge. The baby already had a compromised airway. Now, this has been debated in dentistry since 1909. There was an American journal around at that time in 1909 called Dental Cosmos. And in that, I've come across the article that was written talking about children with mouth open being unattentive in school, not able to concentrate, their faces dull and expressionless. The teacher will accuse the child of not paying attention. The child could be waking up with a headache. So mouth breathing, even though it was documented back 100 years ago, it's really, really become commonplace today, such that 25 to 50% of studied children are shown to be persistently mouth breathing, and no child will reach their full potential if they persistently have the mouth open, because the development of the face, the forward growth of the face, is determined by the pressures exerted by the tongue. And when the mouth is closed and the tongue is resting in the roof of the mouth, the tongue is exerting a pressure to help guide the growth of the jaws forward on the face. And this helps to ensure then an adequate airway. But if the mouth is open, instead what happens is that the face is growing downwards and the jaws then are set back. But when the jaws are set back, the airway is compromised. So it's a combination of the environment meeting genetics. And we do see children being born with high upper palate. And that's something that's becoming more commonplace today. However, it should be recognized early on, because unfortunately, these kids could be at risk in terms of, you know, sudden infant death syndrome. Now, what I would say to parents is, I'm not here to alarm you, but look at the paper by Dr. Christian Gimeno, that nasomaxillary complex. I know it was published in one of the European journals, but it's not that old. It's gone back just a few years. And, you know, go to a functional dentist or a dentist or an orthodontist who has a good understanding of airway, because the other aspect about orthodontistry is that there's two schools of thought. One school of thought is that the child has got crooked teeth because the teeth are too big. The teeth are too big, so let's extract teeth. But the problem is that if you extract teeth, you're making the mouth even smaller again. So you make the mouth smaller, again, there's no room for the tongue. And there's another school of thought in orthodontistry that the reason that the teeth are crooked is not because the teeth are too big, but because the jaw is too small. And the jaw is too small because of lack of chewing food. For example, infants, or not infants, but, you know, young kids now, they're eating food that's pre-chewed. Like burgers and McDonald's and all of this stuff. You know, all of that food, you don't have to chew any of that food. It comes pre-chewed. Where our ancestors were eating food, even youngsters were eating adult food. They had to chew the food, whether it was meat, whether it was vegetables, but even an apple, you know, at least there's some chewing involved in it. And it's the chewing which is also helping to develop the muscles necessary for craniofacial growth. So I think there's probably no one reason, and there's probably several reasons, but it's something that we need to be aware of. And you mentioned ADHD. Karen Bonuch, B-O-N-U-C-H, and I believe she's an American researcher. She did research in Europe in 2009 to 2012, and she looked at 11,000 children in a town called Stratford-upon-Avon in the United Kingdom. And she's seen that these children who had sleep disorder breathing, including snoring, and she implicated mouth breathing as a contributory factor in this. Children with sleep disorder breathing, untreated by age 8, they had 40% increased odds of special education needs. Now, you have other doctors, Dr. Sheldon, I think his first name is Stephen Sheldon. I know he's from the eastern part of the United States. I've seen him stand up in conferences saying that there is no such thing as ADHD. The problem is sleep. These kids are in a total state of sympathetic arousal. They're asleep, their airway is compromised, they're stopping breathing, there's adrenaline rushing through their body, that when they wake up, they're in a state of not just exhaustion, but hyperactivity as a result of the compromised sleep. So for ADHD, for children with special education needs, all parents should be aware of the negative impact of sleep disorder breathing. No child should snore. It's really important to encourage children to breathe through the nose. There are little techniques to help decongest the nose if the child has got a history of nasal obstruction or hay fever. You know, and even running with the mouth closed and looking at the animal world, no animals, with the exception of a dog, persistently mouth breathe. Like, it's really bizarre that humans have lost the basic function that our ancestors knew. Neanderthals, if you put into Google Neanderthal and nostrils, you will see that researchers 2 years ago, they identified that Neanderthals have really wide and large nostrils, and this allowed them to breathe through the nose during physical exercise. So even during physical exercise, our ancestors, they weren't having their mouth open. They were breathing in and out through their nose. So yeah, I would love to see more research on, you know, it's not just about breathe through your mouth or nose. It's, you know, it's really about understanding the complexity and the importance of nasal breathing for cognitive development in children, because children who are left with open mouth breathing, it is going to affect many aspects of their life.
So fascinating how so many things in the body are impacted just by whether you're breathing through the nose or mouth. I mean, just structurally, the jaws, I mean, that's crazy to think that your tongue, if your mouth is closed and your tongue's in the root, resting in the roof of the mouth, then it, as a youngster, as the bones are forming, the jaw is still forming, you'll actually impact the shape of your jaw and and the ability of the teeth to have room to be in the mouth and function. That's incredible. I do want to mention, I found it fascinating, and I forget the name of the author, I don't have the book in front of me, the Shut Your Mouth, Save Your Life.
George Catlin, Caitlin.
Caitlin, yes. So can you tell that story? Can you tell that story real quick about what he observed with the Native American mothers shutting their infant's mouth after they got done eating, breastfeeding?
Yeah, he's apparently George Catlin, he's quite a well-known painter in the United States, and he thought that the tradition of the Native American Indians, he thought that their traditions were dying out. So he went to live with them, or at least that's the story I'm aware of. He went to live with them for 1 year. And during that time, as he was living with them, he documented, you know, how they lived. And he noticed that the Native American mothers, anytime the young infant had the mouth open, that the Native American mother would walk over to the infant and gently just press the lips together to ensure nasal breathing. And he made a comparison of the Native American Indians, who had very calm, restful, deep sleep, compared to the European settlers with their mouths wide open, gasping, and he used those words, gasping into the multitude. You know, that shallow, fast, hard, noisy breathing. And we would never have survived if we were breathing like that throughout our evolution, because we would have been prime target to be eaten. You know, an animal, can you imagine an animal asleep, and the animal who's asleep, who's snoring, any predator can have come upon that animal and take it. Whereas, you know, nowadays it's kind of seen as being the norm. Sleep apnea is seen as the norm. Sleep apnea is not the norm. Sleep apnea is one of those conditions that are, whether it's children or adults, it's really exerting a toll on the body.
Yeah. Well, and I want to remind the listeners, and it's another point from that book, is the mortality rate, infant mortality rate in the modern civilized cities, you know, London and New York and Manchester and these cities, he noted in his book that it was 40 to 50% of kids would not see their fifth birthday in civilized cities. But he specifically would ask the chiefs of each tribe that he went to live with, what was their, how many of their babies died or kids died less than 5 years old or less than 10 years old. And most of the tribes had very few, if any, and it would be from trauma, like a rattlesnake bite, or I think one kid got kicked in the head by a horse or something like that. And I'm not saying it's all because of nasal breathing, but my point is it's there were environmental factors. That mortality rate came down 99% before the measles and whooping cough vaccines came out, because we started to understand some of these factors like hygiene, clean water, sanitation. We still haven't figured out the nasal breathing component of that. And my point being, we need to start to get back to and understand all the different components of health, and including this nasal breathing. Patrick, in the few minutes we have left, could you speak a little bit to, you know, the listener who maybe is interested, and of course I'd recommend jumping on and checking out the workshops and stuff, but maybe a self-assessment. I'm thinking of the breath hold time, you know, some way for people to assess their own breathing, looking at their chest, if it's rising, the breath hold time technique, or certain particular diseases or symptoms that you would think, man, that will definitely respond to some breathing exercises. So kind of some practical self-help assessments and tips. Of course, go to the workshops too, but can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. So what you could use is, we have the control pause, which is a measurement of breath hold time, comfortable breath hold time, and you'll find this on YouTube if you just put in my name, Patrick McKeown, and control pause. But it goes like this. Take a normal breath in, and first of all, you have to sit down for about 5 minutes, just allow your breathing to kind of be comfortable. And then take a normal breath in and out through your nose, and just stop breathing. So you hold your nose, stop breathing, and time it. How long does it take until you feel the first definite desire to breathe, or the first involuntary movement of your breathing muscles? And then let go and breathe in through your nose. And it's a measurement, the measurement of your breath hold time, that provides you feedback of the degree of breathlessness. So, for example, people who have exercise intolerance, and it also provides you feedback of upper chest breathing and fast breathing. So individuals with a low breath hold time, and a low breath hold time, by the way, is less than 25 seconds. So there was research provided by a professor, I think from Evansville University, I'm not sure what state it's in. His name is Professor Kiesel, K-I-E-S-E-L. And he looked at 51 subjects, 27 years of age, and he concluded that breath hold time, when the breath hold time was above 25 seconds, these individuals, there was an 89% chance that dysfunctional breathing wasn't present. So people with a low breath hold time of less than 25 seconds, especially if your breath hold time is 10 seconds, 12 seconds, 14 seconds, for example, your breathing is faster, your breathing is more upper chest, there's no natural pause between breaths, your breathing is harder during sleep, so there's greater resistance to your breathing. And also with obstructive sleep apnea, there is a phenotype called loop gain, that if you have a low breath hold time, one paper by a Harvard medical doctor, Dr. Messino, showed that breath hold time can be a means of diagnosing loop gain in sleep apnea. So 30% of the sleep apnea population have what's called high loop gain. And that means that when they stop breathing, that they have a strong sensitivity to carbon dioxide. That when they stop breathing, carbon dioxide increases in the blood. That when they resume breathing with exaggerated ventilation, which feeds into the next stopping of the breath. So breath hold time is important. It's important to gauge it. Assess whether you are breathing fast or slow, whether you're breathing nose or mouth. You know, if you go for a walk, is your mouth open or closed? Start switching to nasal breathing. You know, really make a concerted effort to have your mouth closed and your tongue resting in the roof of the mouth. And when you're sitting down in the evening, you could put one hand on your chest and your one hand just above your navel, and just gently slow down the speed of your breathing to the point of a light air hunger. And see, does it make a change to your blood circulation, Do you feel any difference, for example, to the temperature of your fingers? Not just because you have your hands against your body, but internally. Does it make you feel drowsy? Because if you, for example, when you're taking a very slow breath in and a relaxed breath out, if you have a prolonged exhalation, it helps to activate the body's relaxation response, the parasympathetic nervous system. So, for example, people with insomnia, really slow down your breathing for about 15 to 20 minutes before sleep. You could do it while just relaxing in the evening time. Make a deliberate effort for slowing down your breath. This helps to activate the body's relaxation response. You fall asleep better and you'll have deeper sleep. People with anxiety, really pay special attention. Are you mouth breathing? Are you sighing a lot? Are you fast breathing? Are you upper chest breathing? It's not just that anxiety is causing fast and upper chest breathing, but we know from the literature that 75% of the anxiety population have fast and upper chest breathing, and it's feeding back into their anxiety. So fast and upper chest breathing, you're telling the body that you're in a fight or flight response. So really make a concerted effort there. Gently slow down your breath. Have your hands either side of your lower ribs. As you breathe in, your ribs are moving out. And as you breathe out, your ribs are moving in. And like, I have some of these exercises up for free anyway on YouTube. If you put in one video that I put up 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, how to breathe while wearing a face mask, because people were saying that they were getting dizzy, they were getting lightheaded, they were having headaches as a result of wearing the face mask, which is mandatory. And I don't get involved in the reasons or the political discussion with it, but what I'm here to do is just to show, if you are wearing a face mask and if you're feeling symptoms, change your breathing pattern. Change your breathing pattern so you're better able to tolerate wearing the face mask. So that's kind of my role more so than anything else. But so a lot of the exercises are for free, and we give the workshops. And the book there, it's on Amazon as well.
Awesome. Well, and again, the name of that book is The Oxygen Advantage. And this has been an amazing interview, Patrick. Thank you so much. I mean, anytime we can find some experts in the field of basic foundational health, I mean, just the way the body was designed to function and bring the science and the why behind it, so beneficial and helpful. So thank you for doing that. Thank you for all your work. I know you're impacting many, many, many lives, and especially these kids now that need our help more than ever. So everybody, check out Patrick's book. Check out the website, oxygenadvantage.com. He's on YouTube. Check out his the classes. And again, Patrick, we really appreciate you being here.
Thanks very much, Dr. Edwards.
Okay, this is Ben Edwards. You're the Cure. We'll be back next week with another great episode.